Support for this public radio podcast comes from Dogpile.com. All of these search engines piled into one. Google, Yahoo, LiveSearch, and Ask.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. The Golden Compass, the movie based on Philip Pullman's international best-selling fantasy novels, opened this weekend at number one at the box office, but not without controversy. Conservative Catholic groups are protesting what they say is a movie filled with subversive ideas, including an evil church-like power that seeks to control everything.
In my world, scholars invented an alethiometer. A golden compass, and it showed them all that was hidden. But the ruling power, fearing any truth but their own, destroyed these devices.
This hour, On Point, the religious storm surrounding the Golden Compass. Joining me from Washington is Hannah Rosen, contributing editor for The Atlantic Monthly. In the December issue, she wrote the article How Hollywood Saved God, which detailed the adaptation of Philip Pullman's novel into the movie The Golden Compass. An expert on religious political issues, she is the author of God's Harvard, a Christian college on a mission to save the nation. Welcome, Hannah. Nice to have you.
Thank you, Jane. It's nice to be here.
And also joining us in the studio is Stephen Prothero. He is the chair of the religion department at Boston University. He's the author of the books Religious Literacy, What Americans Need to Know, and American Jesus, How the Son of God Became a National Icon. Good to have you with us, Steve.
Hi.
Thank you. Hannah, let's start with you. You've seen The Golden Compass. Give us a review. What did you think?
The movie is quite interesting. It sort of sidesteps the religious controversy that you talked about. It does a fabulous job of evoking the fantasy worlds that Pullman creates, the magical worlds that are sort of like our own, but sort of not like our own, like a parallel Oxford University, for example. And it has fabulous lead actresses in Nicole Kidman and Dakota Blue Richards, who plays the main character in the movie. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't really get into the religious controversy except very, very obliquely, and it also cuts off at an odd point. So that's my summary of what the movie is like. It's not, it avoids a lot of the subversive elements of the books, for sure.
Steve, do you agree? What do you think?
Yeah, I think the tougher religious and theological issues are sidestepped in the movie. I think it's, they're trying to make it a little more Hollywoody and a little more secular. And I enjoyed the movie a lot. It's visually great. There's some wonderful characters. I really like the strong heroine in Lyra. Mm-hmm. And it's a really interesting movie.
And yet this movie has a lot of people quite upset. You both say they've sidestepped the religious controversy. The Catholic League calls The Golden Compass atheism for kids. There are calls for boycotts and internet campaigns warning parents against letting their kids see the movie. Catholic schools pulling books off the shelves. Are there religious or anti-God themes in this movie at all, Hannah?
Well, yes. I mean, what happened is, and the response of the Catholic League is more based around the books. They see the movie as kind of an arrow subtly hinting and pointing the way towards the books, which are not only full of religious controversy, as Pullman himself once said, my books are about killing God, but they're also aimed at preteens. The main characters are preteens, and the books are called children's books, even though many, many adults read them and love them, and Pullman doesn't like them to be called children's books, but that's their official category. And so these Christian groups are responding mostly to the books. And in the movies, there is just enough to keep that theme alive. In the books, the main villainous institution is sometimes called the Holy Church. Mm-hmm. In the movie, it's not ever called the Holy Church. It's called the Magisterium. On the other hand, there is mention of heresy. So there are things that point the way to a kind of evil theocracy. And the villainous characters, as I wrote, when you're shot from the waist up, they do look like they're wearing cassocks. They're wearing these sort of black suits. When shot from a distance, it just looks sort of like a generic Nazi uniform. But there are sort of very subtle hints that we might be dealing with a church-like authority here.
To your mind, Steve, how much of Pullman's theology makes it into the film?
Not that much. I think if you read the books, you can read these characters, these sort of evil characters, as members of the church. But if you are going into it without having read the book, I think you might just think they're sort of secular, you know, I don't know, vaguely Russian kind of authoritarian types. I don't think the books, by the way, attack God, nor do I think God is even killed in the books. I think in the books, what's killed is a fake god, an imposter god, as a friend of mine and colleague, Donna Freitas and Jason King, wrote in a book that they published just recently, Killing the Imposter God. It's an imposter god. It's not the real god. The only people who kind of read God as being killed here are, you know, theologically conservative grown-ups. Any kid who reads this book, you know, 12, 14, my daughters, can tell you that God isn't killed here. It's a sort of a Wizard of Oz kind of faker god that's killed here. And what's attacked is authoritarianism, not religion.
Do you agree with that, Hannah?
This is such a complicated issue. I talked to Pullman at length about this.
Yeah, you interviewed him.
I did interview him. And he used to say, you know, 4 years ago, when he wasn't so worried about marketing a movie, my books are about killing God. And he calls himself an atheist and gives lots of speeches about the Republic of Heaven. And he does talk about Western religions as oppressive and destructive forces in history. So he's fairly straightforward. That said, at other times, he says he's talking about something more like a totalitarian regime. In a theocracy, he is unquestionably spiritual in some way. And what exactly his spirituality is something I talk to him a lot about and continue to in emails and conversations.
And what does he say?
You know, it's a spirituality that's almost like a Gnostic spirituality. He does say, I'm not killing God, if you ask him a third time. You know, I'm killing the outdated idea of God as an old man with a beard. So that, in a sense, is true. His spirituality, he tries to explain in the books through the concept of dust. And it has to do with this idea of a kind of collective wisdom, a sort of a particle spirit that collects around all of us and even around material objects, and that grows as we become more wise. And it depends on a certain, it's kind of spiritual, but it's not Eastern mystic spiritual. Like in the books, there's a lot about the I Ching and tarot cards. This isn't very clear, is it? It's very hard for me to understand.
Well, it's very complicated. I mean, I read the article that you wrote where you quote Pullman as referring to the Chronicles of Narnia as the Christian work. And then he says, mine is the non-Christian work. So, I mean, he does allude to that a bit.
Right. No, he definitely alludes to himself as the non-Christian work. And if you read the series, yes, he's not talking about God, but he is very explicit about the Bible and Genesis. I mean, you really could understand the whole series pretty easily as a reversal of Genesis. In fact, that's almost the only way to understand what Lyra is doing and what she's all about. He's extremely offended by the central story of the fall, which he finds to be the basis of Western Christianity, this idea that, you know, nakedness and curiosity, which happens in the beginning of Genesis, causes all the evil to enter into the world. He finds that profoundly disturbing. And in the books, what Lyra's role is to kind of reverse that story. You know, the books end with Genesis in a way,
right,
with Lyra and Will kind of having some sort of sexual falling in love kissing experience. It's unclear exactly what happens. And then the world kind of is set right again because of that. It isn't a bad thing. It's a great thing.
So, Stephen, what about this reversal of Genesis that Hannah refers to? Many people call it the perversion of Genesis, if you will, as it relates to Stephen Pullman's version of it.
Well, I mean, I think this is where the books aren't so much anti-Christian as Christian. You know, they're taking up these Christian themes. They're taking up themes of sin and love and sacrifice and free will and salvation. I mean, these are Christian categories. These aren't categories he's getting from Gnosticism or, for that matter, from Hinduism or Buddhism, although I think there are some Hindu elements in the redemption scene at the end of the third book. But this is a guy who was raised an Anglican. You know, it's hard to get away from your roots when you move into the imagination. You know, my imagination was formed as a young person by listening to Christian stories. And that's part of why I love novels, because it reminds me of that experience as a kid of being engaged with stories. And for Pullman, you know, this is in a lot of ways a thoroughly Christian book. It's a book about, you know, love, being sacrificed so that other people can live, so other people can have freedom, so God can continue to interact with human beings. The God who appears here, there is a God here, and it's God is dust, and God is more immanental than transcendent, and God is loving, and God is consciousness, and God is wisdom. I mean, this is not an anti-Christian book. I'm not a big fan of atheists. I ripped, you know, Christopher Hitchens' book in my review that I wrote about it recently. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sort of, you know, gung-ho for atheism, I'm intrigued by how thoroughly theological and thoroughly spiritual these books are. And I like the idea of engaging young people in these questions rather than telling them, oh, let's not look at this. Let's not think about these issues. You know, let's talk and have conversations with them about them.
Hannah Rosen, I was interested to read that when you interviewed Mr. Pullman, the movie house was quite nervous about that. I guess they see him as a bit of a threat to this film, given how controversial his statements have been.
Yeah, I mean, yes and no, not exactly. They've had, on the surface, very good working relationships, but you can't, you know, Google Philip Pullman and not get nervous if you're
right.
a Hollywood studio that's just spent $180 million. I mean, he's a prolific writer of essays in British newspapers and gives tons of speeches and has won lots of awards, and it's all on the web because there's huge Philip Pullman fans and science fiction fans and fantasy fans who have posted every word that Philip Pullman has ever said. And so it's really not hard to sort of tap into the Pullman controversy. And so I think the studio, and on the other hand, he really wants this film to succeed, and he really wants to see his books. He's not one of these authors who is terrified and scared of putting his books on the screen. He really wants them to be put on the screen, and they've been trying, he and his agent, for a very long time to get this movie made. So I think, as you can see from my story in The Atlantic, he's quite torn about it, and in the interview
right.
he's quite torn about it,
right.
although his bottom line is, I want these movies to succeed.
Well, and he wants the next two to be made, so he sort of cuts himself short when he's talking about this so he doesn't get himself into trouble, I guess.
Exactly.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about all the controversy surrounding the movie The Golden Compass, the Catholic League's boycott of the film, and the reaction of Philip Pullman's fan base to the movie. Conservative Catholics see the evil group in the movie called the Magisterium as a thinly veiled swipe at the Catholic Church. In this clip from the movie, Magisterium member Ms. Coulter, played by Nicole Kidman, tries to convince the heroine Lyra, played by Dakota Blue Richards, that in fact, the Magisterium is all good.
The Magisterium is what people need. They keep things working by telling people what to do.
But you told the master you did whatever you pleased.
Ah, that's right, clever girl. Well, some people know what's best for them, and some people don't. Besides, they don't tell people what to do in a mean, petty way. They tell them what to do in a kindly way, to keep them out of danger.
We're speaking this hour with Hannah Rosen, contributing editor at The Atlantic Monthly. In the December issue, she wrote the article, How Hollywood Saved God, which detailed the adaptation of Philip Pullman's novel into the movie The Golden Compass. And also with us in studio is Stephen Prothro, chair of the religion department at Boston University. I'd like to bring another voice into our conversation now. Joining us from New York is Father James Martin. He's a Jesuit priest and associate editor of the magazine America, a national Catholic weekly. He's the author of A Jesuit Off-Broadway, Center Stage with Jesus, Judas, and Life's Big Questions. Welcome to the program, Father Martin. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So you've seen the movie, The Golden Compass. What'd you think?
Well, you know, I am a big fan of fantasy movies. I love Lord of the Rings and the Harry Potter series. I thought this was interesting visually. I found it a little tedious, actually. And I was trying to think of, you know, what a preteen might think of it. I bet they'd enjoy the adventure. But, you know, and I was a little put off by some of the, what I would say would be the vestiges of the kind of anti-church ideology that lay behind the movie.
So what specifically do you point to as far as the anti-God or the anti-religious themes in the movie?
Well, you know, once again, I'm confining my sort of comments to the movie. But, you know, they use the term magisterium about 50 times in the first half hour. And, you know, for a Catholic, that's the teaching authority of the church. So it sort of baffles me how, you know, the producers can say, well, we don't mean it to be anti-Catholic or anti-church, but we're going to use this term magisterium. I mean, they don't use the term Politburo or, you know, some other construct. There's also a lot of sort of Catholic-flavored words in there, like oblation and heresy and heretic. And there's one scene where the sort of noble bear, the sort of bear hero, has his armor stolen. And you find out that the armor has been stolen by the magisterium. And when you see where it's been hidden, it's basically a church with the pictures of the four saints and a big cross on the top. And so he breaks into that and liberates his armor, which I was kind of surprised at that, just because I had read Hanna Rosin's piece, which was terrific, and I thought that most of that, or at least all of that, was going to be leached out of the movie, but it wasn't.
So you see some of Pullman's theology in the film?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I don't see a lot, and I don't, you know, I was thinking of my nephew who's 9 years old. Would he be able to get all this stuff? Probably not, but you know, for a Catholic and, you know, hearing the word magisterium over and over and over again and about how evil they are, you know, was a little off-putting. My bigger concern is, you know, will it draw people to the books and what will kids make of those books?
And what is your concern about that, that it will somehow change their religious perspectives?
Well, no, that I you know, I haven't read the books, but, you know, I've read a lot of the excerpts. You know, here's a line from one of the books. This is what the church does, and every church is the same. Control, destroy, obliterate every good feeling. So if a war comes and the church is on one side of it, we must be on the other. And that's spoken by a, you know, one of the heroes, a witch. So, you know, I find it hard to believe that a kid wouldn't be in some way prejudiced against the church or the Christian church. And I kind of wonder why I think in this day and age that is acceptable. And you know, any other religious organization or ethnic group or whatever, I think, would be outraged if these books were, you know, used as the basis for a mainstream movie. Mm-hmm. So that's the thing that kind of bothers me. It's mostly, you know, this sort of kind of pointing kids to these books that I think are somewhat problematic.
Let's go to the phones now, Father Martin, and invite some of our listeners into the conversation. Josh is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Josh, hi.
Hi, Jane. How are you doing?
Hi, good. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
Sure.
You know, I'm a youth pastor. I work with teenagers and children. I've been doing that for about 16 years, and I'm in a Southern Baptist church. Personally, I will not be taking my children, and I won't be supporting the movies monetarily myself, just because I do not agree with the viewpoint put out by it. But it often surprises me how much we as Christians expect other people outside of our belief system to care, you know, what we think. And I think one of the great things about living in America is people have the right and the ability to say, look, this is what I believe. I'm writing a book about this thing, you know, and so it becomes incumbent upon me as a parent then to say, you know what, this is appropriate for my child. This is not appropriate. I have three kids of my own, and I, you know, they will not be seeing the movie because they're just too young to be able mm-hmm. to process mm-hmm. and differentiate the themes, just as your father was just saying, to be able to understand and process through those themes. And they're just too young to have to deal with that right now.
Josh, thanks so much for your call. I'll turn to you, Stephen Prothrow. This is a Baptist pastor who's not going to let his kids see the movie. You have daughters. How do you feel?
Well, I'd encourage him to have his kids read the books and give them an opportunity to talk with him as a youth pastor about the themes in here of sacrifice and love and free will and freedom and consciousness, and to talk about to what extent we should question the authority of religious institutions. You know, I think most religious people I know accept the fact that religions do bad things, that religious institutions do bad things. And there's a distinction between, you know, the religious impulse that we have inside ourselves and the way it gets manifest in organizations, which any good Roman Catholic will tell you that, you know, the Roman Catholic Church is a human, you know, institution. I mean, churches have, you know, the sinfulness of human beings in them. And so I would encourage people to have their kids read these books, have their kids see the movie if they're old enough to take in the themes, and then talk about them. I would be really sad if we start to have a religious test for our novelists, as if, you know, if there's a Hindu novelist and we're Christians, we think, oh, we can't read that novel because this person is a Hindu, or if they're a Buddhist or if they're an atheist, we have to sort of have them pass a religious test. I think we should read these novels as novels.
Back to the phones now, and Cheryl, who's calling from Wakefield, Rhode Island. Hi, Cheryl. Welcome.
Hi, everybody. Just a quick observation, and I really appreciate the comments that were just made. I'm a philosopher by profession, and I have an 8-year-old child who is a precocious reader and is a big Philip Pullman fan. I mean, really obsessed on these novels for about half a year. And what worries me about the impulse to censor reading of these books by Catholic friends who have called me about this and said, what should I do, is that the Catholic Church is in no position to censor thoughtful critiques of power in religious institutions given the sex abuse scandals. You know, so that's the first comment, is that, you know, I think the church ought to be a little bit more modest in organizing any kind of objection to these novels, given the scandal it's just come off of. I think the time for a thoughtful critique of power and institutions of churches is welcome. The second thing is that, you know, this is not a new critique. Kierkegaard in the 19th century, a Christian himself, gave a very thoughtful and impassioned critique of institutional power. And the way these are sublimated in the book is beautiful. And keep in mind that the Pullman books were thought to be the best books for young people in 70 years by librarians who pick prizes. So these are thoughtfully and imaginatively dealt with. And my 8-year-old was not traumatized. It was thought-provoking for her. The book also deals with souls outside of the body, which is a traditional spiritual theme. So thank you.
Cheryl, thanks so much for your call. Father Martin, do you want to respond to Cheryl?
Well, yeah. First of all, I mean, the Catholic Church has not said anything officially about these books. I mean, the Catholic League, I think a lot of people in the media seem to think that the Catholic League is the Catholic Church. I mean, they're the ones calling for the boycott. Catholic News Service, which is the arm of the Bishops' Conference in the United States, actually called the movie lavish, well-acted, and fast-paced. So there's no one calling for a boycott officially in the church. But, you know, I also think, you know, obviously the Catholic Church, you know, has made a lot of mistakes, especially in the past couple of years, and they're full of sinful people. Everybody is, you know, a mixed bag of, you know, sin and good. But I still think that, you know, I think it's disingenuous to say that this is just an attack on churches in general when they use such sort of specifically Catholic terminology. So, you know, I mean, I think just parents should know that before they, you know, encourage their kids to read the books.
Hannah Rosen, how do you respond to that?
I think this is very complicated. I also have a young daughter who's a very precocious reader, and there is a way in which they see the authors of these books as kind of, you know, wisdom figures and godlike figures, and they do believe what's said in these books. In the Golden in the series, His Dark Materials, in the last, this is the thing that turns off most of my Catholic friends. There's an ex-nun turned physicist who talks to Lyra and her friend Will, and this really feels like a point in the books which many people say, you know, Pullman has stepped out of the narrative and is sitting this woman down to lecture these young kids about religion. And basically, she has given up being a nun, and she does talk very explicitly about the evils of religion and how it destroyed her life and her ability to love and all the bad that religion does in the world. So it really does feel like, for many parents, Pullman sitting down and taking their kids by the hand and talking to them. And part of the reason he's such a powerful enemy is, unlike what the Baptist pastor said, he does take religion seriously. It's not that he's ignoring religion or dismissing it the way, say, Christopher Hitchens does. He's not a cold atheist that way. He's extremely spiritual and takes these issues very seriously and then rejects them and comes up with what could only be described as an alternative theology, which may include many Christian values such as sacrifice and love, but is not Christian.
Stephen Prothero, you wanted to make the distinction between criticizing organized religion and criticizing God, per se.
Right, and these are things that young people can understand. You know, my daughter, my 14-year-old daughter, read these books when she was in fourth grade, and I think that, again, I think that it's older people who have, you know, have problems who kind of want to read these things literally. I don't think my daughter had a sense that she was being lectured by Pullman, or that when she got out of the book she needed to become an atheist because of it. I think that kids understand novels, and particularly these are fantasy novels, understand fantasy novels as entries into conversation, and that's my real concern here. I'm worried that some kids are being told, you know, through their church or through, and some evangelicals are boycotting this too, that they shouldn't engage in this conversation. This is a wonderful conversation to have about a lot of Christian themes, a lot of religious themes. And if you criticize the church, it's very different from criticizing God. And if you criticize, you know, the bad people in the Catholic Church or the bad things that bad people in the Catholic Church have done, that's very different from criticizing Christianity.
Back to the phones now. Eric is calling from Gulf Shores, Alabama. Welcome to you, Eric. Hi.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
I just wanted to kind of draw some attention to the inherent right that we have as an American to express whatever opinion it may be. And then when it comes to a movie like this, from the point of a movie maker, if there is some real, you know, genuine feeling that might agree with whatever is being said, you know, if you could imagine him coming out and saying, this is a Christian religion, we are, you know, we're going against that religion, how it would be then. But now, you know, I think you're seeing a growing trend. There's a lot of people living in the shadows that really feel a lot of the things that are being said in this film, even though they're, you know, basically just, you know, all fiction. But
Eric, thanks so much. I'm going to turn it over to Hannah Rosen to respond to your comments. Hannah, go ahead.
I want to read here something that Pullman said about the movie itself, where he said, and this is, again, he's quite ambivalent because he really did not want to criticize the movie and he loves it in many ways. What he said was that they did keep the theology off the film, is how he put it. And then he said, I think if everything that is made explicit in the book, or everything that is implied clearly in the book, or everything that can be understood by a close reading of the book were present in the film, they'd have the biggest hit they've ever had in their lives. If they allowed the religious meaning to be fully explicit, it would be a huge hit. Suddenly, they'd have letters of appreciation from people who felt this but never dared say it. They would be the heroes of liberal thought or freedom of thought, and it would be the greatest pity if that didn't happen. Now, he had let himself go a little bit, but I think he's expressing the same sentiment as this last reader, is that this film could become a repository for people who want to express their objections to organized religion but don't really have a place to put it.
Stephen Prother wants to jump in here.
You know, one thing that annoyed me about J.K. Rowling's conversation about the Harry Potter books is that she seemed to assume that she had the right to tell us what they meant. And I don't think Philip Pullman has the right to tell us what these books mean or the movie. You know, once they're out there, once the novel is out there, it stands on its own. And it may have an atheist as an author, but I, as a reader, can find a lot of Christianity in it. I can find God in it. And I would defy anyone not to read these books as thoroughly theological and, in many senses, Christian. And let me say one thing about Father Martin's comments. I find it very disturbing to have, you know, a paragraph quoted totally out of context from the novels by a gentleman who admits he hasn't even read the novels. I mean, this is exactly the way I hope that in Christian institutions we would say, don't read the Bible this way. You know, read it as a whole text. You can't be commenting on and criticizing and saying, I hope that young Catholic kids, you know, don't read these novels if you haven't read them yourselves. I mean, you read it yourself and then tell me that you think that this is something that's nefarious and going to take people away from the church. I don't think it will.
Father Martin, I'll let you respond.
Well, I made it clear that I didn't read the books, first of all. And second of all, I'm not telling anyone not to read them. I'm just saying that, you know, it seems that from, you know, people that I've spoken to, that these are the themes that this man is, that the author is talking about. And I think even taken out of context, some of these things are pretty shocking. And, you know, as a Catholic, I read this stuff and it's shocking. That's all I'm saying. I'm not advocating censorship or, you know, the movie should be drummed out of the theaters. But I also think, you know, for me, it's very hard, and maybe this is just my personal fallacy, but it's very hard for me to separate the guy's ideology from the books, you know, when I read them and I see the movie. So that's difficult for me. And I think if it's difficult for me, who's sort of trying to separate this stuff, I wonder if it'll be even more difficult for children.
Go ahead, Stephen.
Do you think that Catholic high schools that are pulling these books off the shelves should be doing that? Or would you agree with me that that's a wrong way to go here?
Oh, I agree that any sort of censorship is wrong. I mean, I'm arguing more for sort of, you know, people to understand what they're getting themselves into. But also, by the same token, I guess it's hard for me to, you know, I read Hannah Rosen's piece, and it's very hard for me to say, well, these books are really not about anything more than the story. I mean, if the guy has this, what seems to me to be an agenda, then this is one way that it seems like he's trying to carry this out. So I'd ask you, do you think that the guy's agenda is sort of divorced from the art that he's doing?
I think you can separate them, I do.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This hour, we're discussing the controversy surrounding last weekend's number one box office movie, The Golden Compass. One of the movie's major themes is the relationship between humans and animals. In this next scene, Lyra gains the friendship of an armored bear named Yorick, voiced by Ian McClellan.
What is your name, child?
Lyra Balaqua.
Then, Lyra Balaqua, I owe you a debt. I will serve you in your campaign until I am dead, or you have a victory.
We're speaking with Stephen Prothrow, chair of the religion department at Boston University, Father James Martin, a Jesuit priest and associate editor of America, a Catholic weekly magazine, and Hannah Rosen, contributing editor for The Atlantic Monthly, who has written about the Golden Compass in the December issue. Hannah, there was a lot of haggling, as I've read in your pieces, that went on during the rewriting, the writing and the rewriting of the film script. How did that work?
Yes, the script went through several versions, and a lot of what they were trying to work out was exactly how to characterize the villains and what they were trying to do. And so they started out, there was an original script by Tom Stoppard, which had much more priest-like characters in it and much more explicit discussions about sin and Genesis and sort of a lot of scenes where the men would be hashing out what the meaning of these various things were and what heresy meant. And then as time went on, that got kind of leached out of the script. And so in a second version, they talked about the dying of death, and they made sort of more oblique references to Genesis. And then by the final shooting script, there really wasn't much of that. As they explained it to me, they meant Dust to act more like the Force. They just wanted people to think of Star Wars, not of the Catholic Church. And so they wanted the Force to be Dust, or the Force to be something that you could use for good or for evil. And the main character ended up sounding a little bit like Obi-Wan Kenobi, and there were kind of a lot of generic, we will fight the Force kind of lines. But then what happens in the actual movie, I'm not sure if I want to spoil it for people or not, but they basically just kind of spliced the whole scene, the whole controversial scene that they've worked a long time to try and figure out exactly how to portray it, which is the last scene in the movie and the very, very, by far the most controversial chapters of the book. They just, in the end, ended up cutting it out. So well, the movie's quite short and ends quite abruptly.
Yeah, but that brings up an interesting point, how some of the more controversial issues were sidestepped in this movie, but in the second or third round, if they finish the trilogy on screen, it won't be that easy.
I can't even imagine it. I mean, in the Golden Compass, Philip Pullman is just kind of laying out the meaning, and he is fairly gentle. And until the very last few chapters of the book, you really don't get what he's talking about or really what's going on if you're reading with a theological eye. But by the second or third book, it becomes much more difficult because you really have a war going on between the forces of God and everybody else. And then you have the death of God. How are you going to play that scene, even if it is a feeble old man? I mean, even if it's not, God, it's still going to be kind of hard because he calls himself the Lord, Yahweh, the authority. I mean, anything we mm-hmm. all understand to be God, he gets killed. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of a pathetic figure. And then, in the last scene, you've got this ex-nun sort of lecturing the I don't know how you're going to do it.
Stephen Prothero, you actually believe that the main character in the film, this preteen orphan Lyra, is actually an unusual hero for young girls. In what way?
Yeah, I mean, my daughters get dressed up as Hermione, at Halloween and for the Harry Potter parties. And, Hermione is a wonderful character, but she's sort of, carrying the water for Harry Potter, who gets to be the hero. And it's really unusual in young adult literature to have a wonderfully strong heroine that young girls can identify with. And I love that about these books, and I love that about the movie. I think that it's wonderful to tell girls to question authority, to make a little trouble, to be suspicious when people talk in God's name, as if God is speaking to them through an earphone, as if they know exactly what God thinks. I think that's a healthy thing, and frankly, a religious and theological thing for kids to do. And I think it's wonderful to have girls be able to look to books that they love and say, there's a character that I admire and that I can learn something from.
Father Martin, what did you think of the main character, Lyra, this young girl?
Oh, I'd agree with that. I mean, it's always wonderful to see a young girl in a heroic role. I agree with Mr. Prothero that there's really a dearth of that. You look in vain in Lord of the Rings for, one woman who's not, sort of otherworldly. I mean, who's actually a real person. So she's a very compelling heroine. And, I'd say one of the things I found most interesting about the movie is this whole idea of the demon, which is kind of your soul being separate from you, which was kind of charming, I found. Once again, I would imagine most kids are going to go to the movie and probably enjoy it for its sort of fantasy elements and for the visual effects. As Hannah Rosen was saying, they might be a little confused about the plot. I mean, I had a hard time even following it, towards the end. But, taken on its own, it's fun. Once again, it's the question of, and once again, I haven't read them, but the question of, does this lead them to the books and, what sort of ideologies behind the books and, what do parents think about that. So, but I also want to say, I want to come back from the discussion we had. I am not in favor of censoring or, burning books or anything like that. But I also think that, as a Catholic, I have the right to sort of critique something that I think is somewhat, you know, problematic at least.
Can I say one more thing about
Lyra?
Go
ahead, Hannah.
Lyra is a very interesting person to talk about because Pullman will say, well, Lyra just came to me. You know, I didn't choose Lyra. It was just sort of obvious to me that she should be the central character. But what went into that choice are many complicated things. One was a response to fantasy fiction, this idea of Lord of the Rings, which he criticizes a lot. You know, and the other was a response to the church. I mean, this idea of patriarchy and misogyny and the idea that she should be Eve and she should rewrite the story of Eve. So it's hard to talk about any element of this without getting right back into the controversy. Nobody would know this from watching the movie, and it's perfectly possible to read the books and just say, oh, wonderful, there's a female heroine. Isn't that great? It's unlike other fantasy stories. But it is clear that he chose her for a particular theological reason.
Stephen?
And I would argue, you know, in keeping with my colleagues, Donna Freitas and Jason King in this book, Killing the Imposter God, that what we have there is something like quite like feminist theology. You know, this is a point that feminist theologians have been making for more than a generation, that we shouldn't be thinking about God as this old man with a beard in the sky. We should be thinking about God in more feminine terms. And what's wrong with you know, taking a critical eye to the standard reading of the Genesis story and saying, why do we have to have the woman be the villain here? Why can't she be the hero?
In fact, Pullman, when I interviewed him, he was joking. You know, there's been a lot of books written about these books by people who are great fans of his. And he said that the latest wave of critiques of the Dark Materials were explaining how he was, in fact, a Christian. And he was chuckling about that because he never expected it, even though he would like it. And so he was pleased by it.
Let's go back to the phones now from Buffalo, New York. Jennifer's on the line. Jennifer, hi. Welcome.
Hello, Jane. I'm glad that you have a priest on your program, but I feel that this conversation's been one-sided because he hasn't read the books. I've read all three of them. I'm a parent of a fifth grader who's quite a capable reader, and in fourth grade he was handed this book in his Catholic school. And I'd like to say that I'm not someone who wants to ban books out of schools, but I was upset by this book being handed to him because I told my son that I was going to talk to him about this when he got to high school, that this was a book for a child in high school to be reading to discuss the themes in it because it is rather complex and is very, when you get to the second and third book, it is definitely not a hit only on organized religion, but on any idea of God in Christianity. I have a real hard time understanding where they're coming up with the ideas that this could be, you know, some kind of Christian themes. And what really bothers me is there's a nun in this book who says that, you know, Christianity is a complex mistake, but she arrives at that through having a sexual, you know, she has sex with a man and realizes this is all a farce, and she's actually the best written character in the book. I actually think Lyra is not particularly well written. She's not as three-dimensional. Maybe Will is a little better. And another last thing is that the end of the first book, Lord Asriel, her uncle, actually father, kills her best friend out of his own egotism to find these parallel universes and enter another world. And at the end of the book, you're rooting for people who, even if you weren't Christian, I mean, what they do to get to their ends to prove this. I mean, this book is, and it's actually kind of a mess, the third book, in terms of writing. And you know, the things of hell and harpies, and there's actually no heaven, and God dies, you know, decrepit old man at the end of it. I mean, it is a mess, and I encourage people to read these books and realize that this is not really appropriate material for children that are, this is targeted. Pullman has targeted these from fourth to eighth grade. I mean, you know, I am not for banning books, but I think that you've got to realize what you are throwing in the hands of very young minds who might, you know, not be able to understand what's going on.
Jennifer, thank you so much for your call. Hannah Rosen, do you want to respond?
Yeah, that was a very real, authentic response. I mean, from a parent, you can see it's very hard to read these last two books and not think, well, you know, anything I've ever understood as Christian is being really trashed in these books, and I'm not sure how my kid will understand it. Now, I would say maybe she responded well by sort of in talking to her child about the books and maybe what was in the books and saying, can we wait until later? And so I don't know if that would fall under the category of censoring or you know, engaging or what, but it was a real response there.
Back to the phones now. And Jim, who's calling from West Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hi.
I want to make the following point. It seems to me that the idea of God that Pullman criticizes in the book, and criticizes the idea by killing off this feeble old white guy who's quote-unquote God, it seems to me that that's kind of a good message for Jews, Christians, and Muslims, because really nobody who's got a sophisticated theology is going to buy that God is this this white guy on high sitting in a throne, or any guy on high, or any human on high. I mean, they're not going to take the anthropomorphisms of God that are in the Bible literally, just as a sign that God, you know, really, you know, empathizes with us in the deepest way. And I think that opening up this question of what God is and what God isn't, and getting to the point where most Jews, Christians, and Muslims would say, and I'm a Jew, would say, you know, we cannot really, you know, put the finger on exactly what God is. Getting to that point in a conversation with a 9-year-old is a good thing, because you're building a much more resilient theology than somebody believes, oh, it's just this father or mother figure up on high who's going to do good things for us and punish us when we're bad.
Jim, thanks so much for your calls. Steve Prothero?
You know, it's always a challenge to get your kids to talk and think about big questions, you know, and about theological questions. The Catholic Church doesn't do a very good job of it. Neither do most Protestant churches. You know, I joke with my Catholic students about, you know, so many of them are ex-Catholics, you know, and they get bored by the church. And a lot of the mainline Protestants are bored. These kids are not being engaged around big questions. I worry about that. And I think these are the kinds of books that do engage kids. And I think what we should be doing with our kids, whether we're theological or not, or Christian or Jewish or Muslim, is, you know, here they are engaged with these books. These are lively books. These are great characters. And use it as an opportunity to do just what this gentleman's doing. Talk about God. You know, is God actually a man? You know, what does it mean to say God's actually a man? Does God have a body? You know, is this feeble person? I find it humorous that any reader could imagine, and I've never met a kid who thinks this, that Pullman is killing off God here. This is a feeble-like man in a bubble with a decrepit old body. I mean, how could that possibly be God?
Father Martin, do you want to jump in here?
Yeah, no, it's a great point. I mean, I think that's a very interesting point in terms of kind of encouraging kids and young adults to think about these theological matters. And also, I find it interesting, the whole idea of kind of killing the patriarchal God is interesting, too. I'm curious, not having read the books, I'd like to ask Hannah and Stephen, what, you know, when they kill this sort of fake God, and I'm really asking this out of ignorance, is there a real God who is kind of revealed, or what's the sort of, who's the sort of substitute God? Do they ever find the real God, or is it just kind of this republic that they set up? I mean, I find that...
Well, first, just to address this idea of who the God is, I mean, he does say, you know, one of the angels says when they're describing who the enemy is, the authority, God, the creator, the Lord, Yahweh, El, Adonai, the King, the Father, the Almighty. Those were all the names he gave himself.
But that's a confusion, though, Hannah. That's a confusion.
It's a little bit complicated, but it's not that complicated.
We're not supposed to think that's true when we read it.
Why? I mean, that's the angel defining who the enemy is, because, and that's the person who they kill, and that person has this, you know, evil guy, Metatron, who carries out his will, and there really is no, I mean, what is the alternative? The alternative is this thing called dust, and it's like this godlike energy that resides in all of us. And, you know, Pullman is not in any way a New Age kind of guy, but that's a kind of New Age idea, and I think in some ways the reason that Pullman is resonant in this day is because we live in an age in which people create their own religions, and so you have Jubus who call themselves Jewish and, you know, take a little bit from Yahweh but take a little bit from Buddhism, or you have Christians who sort of pull from all sorts of different traditions, and that's what the bestseller list is about. And so, you know, people can understand Pullman in that sense, a little bit from this and a little bit from that.
Let's take one more call before we finish up the hour. From Norwich, Vermont, is Tom on the line. Hi, Tom. Welcome.
Hi. I'm actually really disappointed that you didn't have anyone on who is actively calling for a boycott, because this is really actually happening, and to me that's where the real heat in the conversation comes from.
Okay.
Groups who call for boycotting are simply proving Pullman's point that religion has a cult-like tendency to keep people from hearing ideas that the religion considers heretical. So, I don't know, maybe somebody can argue that point.
Tom, thanks. Steve?
Well, that's one of the funny things, even when I was watching the movie and certainly thinking about the books, is, you know, Pullman say, you know, this is what organized religion does. It tries to get you to take away your imagination. And your imagination is for you. Your imagination is for you to exercise your freedom. And yes, it's ironic that it's as if Pullman is sort of scripting at least these Catholic League and you know, right-wing evangelical types to be boycotting this, to make his point that, you know, religion, at least at its best, doesn't do this sort of thing.
Father Martin, I'll give you the last word here, and then Hannah.
Well, I would agree that religion at its best does not do that, and I think, frankly, from a sort of theological and spiritual standpoint, censorship and boycotting is wrong. I think people need to have the freedom of inquiry and freedom of thought. And also, from a practical standpoint, I think boycotts just make more people read the books. You know, a friend of mine once said that when the Da Vinci Code came out, what the Catholic Church should have done is said, we order everyone to read this and fewer people would have read it.
Hannah Rosen, 20 seconds for you.
I'm just going to read this great quote from Pullman, who talks about the moral power of stories. Thou shalt not might reach the head, but it takes once upon a time to reach the heart.
Mm. Hannah Rosen, contributing editor for The Atlantic Monthly, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Stephen Prothro, chair of the religion department at Boston University. Great to have you in studio. Thanks.
Thanks, Jane. I enjoyed it.
And Father James Martin, associate editor of America Magazine, a Catholic weekly. Father Martin, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Thanks to all for a lively conversation. You can continue it and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.